Murray Sodema, Barb Ness, Chuck Britton are not here, huh? Good morning, class. This is our last session for this year, but don't forget we come back next year, for another semester of Methods of Bible Research 1, and we're going to be dealing with how to write a research paper. We're going to be dealing with more explicit information on how to deal with referenced works and Bible research tools and how to use them in conjunction with one another. We'll be doing more assignments in order to implement this information. We'll be dealing with some of the various methods in more detail as well. Now, remember that the last day for you to turn in any tape notes, assignments, or tests will be tomorrow, Friday, unless any special arrangements have been made individually. Will be tomorrow, Friday, December 22nd. So as the roll book goes past the last time here in class, please check across for your name, across the dates of the semester, and if you see any X's without my initial in them, then write those dates down and get the tapes made up and get them into me right away. Also, any late papers that I receive that I pass back late will be in the Bible College Library. Make sure you pick all those papers up for all your classes. They probably won't be starting to put them in there until tomorrow. Probably starting tomorrow or over the weekend, the teachers will start bringing them in there. But you might want to check several times during the break, because some teachers might still be grading things later and they'll keep bringing more papers in. So if you don't find all your papers in there the first trip you make, you might want to check a little bit later. Now, today, we're going to continue in our brief survey of the Bible College Library, just giving you a feel for what is in some of these sections, giving a few of the key books, and how you can use these sections to supplement your classes. The first one we're going to talk about is church history. I have it here on the board. Church history is pretty explanatory, self-explanatory. It's the history of the church. And some of these church histories really are valuable in giving you some insights into some of the important events that transpired in church growth and the deterioration of the church. Times of revival. Others are not quite as valuable. Some are very general. They're just a history of the Christian church from the time of the apostles all the way up until the 1800s or 1900s, and they're just a general church history. They try to give you a running picture, chronological, of what happened from one century, one decade to the next, who the main men were, who the main movements were, what some of the heresies and cults were, what some of the revivals were, what some of the dark times were. Others are much more specific or narrow in their scope. Some just deal with revivals. Some just deal with early church history. Some just deal with, specific men would be in the biographies, Christian biography section, but narrower elements of it. Some just on the Reformation. Some on the Middle Ages, some on the church fathers, the church councils, and whatnot. And so depending on what you're looking for, it will dictate which kind of a church history book you'll be using. I think church history is one of the most interesting. To me, it was one of the most interesting subjects in the Bible College, because that's what we're in. We're not in Bible history days. We're in church history days. The Old and New Testament days are gone, and now we're in church history, so to speak, and so we're looking at our spiritual ancestors, our spiritual forefathers. It's like Jacob could look back and see Isaac, how he had walked with God, and Abraham and their trials, victories, battles, defeats. We can look back to our Abraham and Isaacs, as it were, in the Christian faith, and we can see the fantastically inspiring stories of, for example, the martyrs who were burned at the stake, thrown to the lions, covered with tar and pitch and put on fire to light Nero's gardens and during the circuses and the various things, and sang, died singing in the flames, singing praises unto Jesus. And we can see some of the dark times, the Middle Ages, when the midnight hour of the papacy came and the popes were read like something off the scandal sheets of the Midnighter or something, in their lives and that they led, and the harlotry, the adultery, the fornication, the murder, the political intrigues, the conniving that they were involved in. And it's really very dramatic, sometimes disheartening, sometimes encouraging, always worthwhile study, the study of church history. And some of the more commonly used ones in the Bible College here are what we've put here, and of course you're familiar with some of them now because of the Servetus assignment: Miller's, Schaff's, three volumes, Walker's, and La Tourette's. Those are probably the four standard ones that that are in use in the Bible College here. There are others, of course, some of them multi-volume, like Mosheim's and Neander's, and other one-volume ones by some other men, but these are some of the standards, not that the others aren't any good. And then over here on the other side, I've got some other books that are not in the church history section. They're in the Bible dictionary section, but they have church historical information. And you're familiar with all of these now, at least to some degree, after you did that Bible dictionary survey. Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church is a extremely valuable book. Gives thumbnail sketches of and biographies of some of the main figures in church history, some of the main doctrines, some of the main heresies, some of the main movements. And it's really excellent type of book to go to if you just want a scrap of information. When was Martin Luther born? When did the Reformation start? Who was Pope in 1525? What doctrine? When was the Salvation Army started? What was the main doctrine believed by the Brethren Church? Or who started the Brethren movement? Just different things in church history that would come up that you want to have a piece of information on. You don't want to take the time to wade through a long church history book to try to get to that point in history and find it. Just grab one of these and you usually find what you're looking for. This was written, by the way, by an Episcopalian scholar. Cross is his last name. I think it's Frank L. Cross. He sometimes gives you a little bit of liberal theology. I don't know if you've noticed that when you surveyed it, but on some of the doctrinal areas, he leans a little bit more towards the liberal camp than towards the conservative camp. But generally, he's pretty fair, pretty objective, pretty thorough, as much as you can be in a real concise, format, in the information that he'll give you for church history. And then he sometimes gives you some literature, little bibliographies after the articles of other books that you could look up if you want to dig into it further. And then one that goes right along with that, which is the exact same type of book, is the red one there, it's not red here, it's red in the library, the New International Dictionary of the Christian Church by J.D. Douglas, editor. J.D. Douglas also was the editor of the New Bible Dictionary, and he may have even been involved in the New International Commentary and the New Bible Commentary, I'm not sure. But Douglas's work is more recent than the edition of Oxford Dictionary that we have. The Oxford one we have is not the latest edition available, although it's fairly recent. I think it was done in the 60s, or maybe even early 70s. I think it was late 60s. But now there's one out you can get, which we don't have. We may get it eventually if we come into a windfall here or something. More recent edition, where he revises and updates some of the information. It's really costly. I checked it in a bookstore one time, and it was well over $40. $40, one book. Of course, it's a big, thick book, and it's got an awful lot of information in it. It's got a lot in it, but my, that's a lot of money for one book. So we maybe a while before we get the revised edition, unless somebody wants to donate it or something. But the New International Dictionary is more recent than the edition we have. The New International is really recent, 74, 75, 76, something like that. And I found it to be, on the whole, more conservative than the Oxford one. Douglas is more conservative, more evangelical in his viewpoint of church history. And oftentimes he'll even do something which is, I find as librarian, quite helpful, and that is, you'll be looking up the name of a theologian or some Bible commentator or something, and he'll very often let you know by what he says whether that person was liberal or conservative in his theology, which for me is extremely helpful because I'm going through catalogs and looking at books all the time for possible inclusion in the library, and sometimes I'll come across the name of an author, you know, Commentary on Judges by, you know, John Smith. Well, John Smith, maybe I've never heard of him before. I want to find out as much about this fellow as I can before, you know, laying out the dough for his commentary. And so where do you go for information? Well, these two books are places you can go, Oxford and the New International. Look up the man's name, and if he was important enough, you know, among the scholars of church history, his name will be there. When he was born, when he died, what church he attended, where he was educated, what some of his main works are, and sometimes what his theological position was. Now, another one is the new Schaff-Herzog Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge. That's that 13 volume tan one that you looked at, which has been updated to the 1950s by a 2-volume supplement called the 20th Century Encyclopedia of Religious Knowledge, but it's the same thing. It goes with that set and it updates it up to the 1950s, 55 I think, because the 13 volume set, the new Schaff set, is only up to about the 19-teens, 1910, 1912, 1913, right in there. But for its field and for what it does, it's one of the best, particularly for biography, for men wanting to know their background and where they came from and what their doctrines and what their works are. It's very, very thorough, very long bibliographies at the end and everything. And some of the articles that it has on theological subjects are some of the most excellent ever written in terms of high level of scholarship and so forth, but it's a committee work. It was written by many theologians, many of whom were continental theologians from Germany and France and so forth, and so there's liberal theology, and so one article might be a real high-quality, excellent conservative, and then another article written by somebody else might be just atrocious. You might not find hardly a scrap of anything in there that's worth using. So anytime you have a committee work, be it commentary or Bible dictionary or whatever, it's going to be, you know, no stronger than its weakest link, any chain is. And so they're usually spotty, but it's got some good things in it. And then there's the Dictionary of Christian Biography. That's those four thick blue volumes that are in the Bible dictionary section. Now that is just what it says, Christian biography. In other words, it gives you biographies of Christians, people that lived in church history. But it only goes up to the 8th century after Christ. So it's only going to give you people from maybe the time of Christ or a little bit after, up to the 700s or 800s right in there. So you couldn't look up Luther in there. He wouldn't even be in there. It's only the first 8 centuries of church history. But for those first 8 centuries, it is thorough. I mean, people you've never heard of, you just thumb through it sometime and you'll see all these names of the Latin fathers and the scholars and the early martyrs of the faith and everybody and every possible scrap of information that was available on these men in the banks of history. They've gathered it all together and written long scholarly biographies on them, and in its field, it's one of the best. It still hasn't been outdone, although it would be really neat if they had one like that all the way up to the 1970s that was that thorough. It'd be, you know, probably fill that whole Bible dictionary section if we had it, but unfortunately, it hasn't been done to my knowledge. But that's what that is. And now, I'll tell you where this can be real helpful. When you're studying, obviously, all of these are good for church history class, they supplement it, but particularly if you're in early church history, and when you're studying about, you know, the Sabellians and the Montanists and the Patripassionists and the Athanasian Creed, Athanasius, Tertullian, Origen, all these people in early church history that were embattled and embittered in the doctrinal controversies over the nature of God and the things you've studied in Unfolding Rev 1. That's a good book to go to find information about that and these men and when they lived. Not that it's necessarily going to be totally unbiased in its viewpoint of what they were believing. They might call something occult that, you know, we would consider to be biblical in some of its positions. And they might call something biblical that we would consider, you know, anti-biblical. But nevertheless, it's generally pretty objective and super thorough. And that's where it can be really of interest and use in that early period of church history. Okay. Any questions on the church history section and these other books that go with it? Charlie. Well, when I say a committee work, for example, the New International Dictionary is a committee work as well. Douglas was just a managing editor, and there were others. What they do is they assemble a group of scholars, not necessarily assemble, but get in touch with them all and acquire their services, probably through, you know, monetary stipends, you know. And then they find people that are specialists in these various fields. So a Bible dictionary, for example, if it's a committee work, well, archaeology. We'll get William F. Albright, we'll get Merrill F. Unger, we'll get Howard F. Voss, we'll get some of these archaeologists, and we will commission them to write articles on archaeology in Jerusalem as it's been dug up, the excavations, different areas. We'll farm those articles out to them, and we'll commission them to write them. And then in the area of church history, we'll get whoever's a church historian today. In other words, they take the people that are specialists in their fields, and they commission them, and they give them. They're working under a deadline, like anybody in the publishing business. And by that deadline, they have to come up with articles well researched, and a lot of times, a work will have a viewpoint. And so, if it's, for example, Interpreter's Bible Dictionary, the viewpoint is generally liberal. And most of the people that contributed to that, I believe that's a committee work as well, were of the liberal persuasion. And I'm sure that the managing editor, under the auspices of Abingdon or whoever the publisher was directed, or unwritten law that we're not going to go to the, conservative like Dallas Theological Seminary and Moody Bible Institute and Fuller Theological Seminary for our men. We'll go to Harvard and Yale and University of Chicago and the liberal institutions, and we'll get our men from there. And so the whole work reflects a general tone or tenor. And vice versa, in the conservative works, like Douglas and his, I know he went pretty much to the conservative scholars, those that are basically evangelical persuasion, so the whole thing would bring across the same flavor, the same basic viewpoint, with some room for variation within certain bounds. And so then they'll contribute all these articles, and then it's the duty of the editor or editors. Sometimes they have an editor over the Department of Archaeology, editor over Bible manuscripts, editor over that, and then a managing editor over all of it. So it's just like a business where you've got a whole setup of government of people, all that have to give account to somebody above them, and then the managing editor, probably the publisher, on top of the whole heap. And so they just compile all this information, the editors go over it and revise and amend and make suggestions and work with the people and changes, and then they gather all the information and they just put it together. Now when you've got a work done by one man, sometimes that will in a sense be a committee work too, because sometimes if you look on the front page, even though it's, for example, Unger's Bible Dictionary, he'll give credit to about three or four other men who did help him in certain areas. Unger's does that, for example. By the way, Unger's is kind of different anyway in that the whole thing is a revision of an old Bible dictionary that was done around 1900. I can't remember the name of the person, but it was an older one, and Unger just took it and reworked it and updated it and revised it and added to it. So he started with an older one and that was probably out of print and out of copyright, and then took it and revised it. But his was still a committee work in a sense, because he farmed out some areas, although he did quite a bit of it himself. But there are strengths and weaknesses in both, Charlie. A committee work has the strength of having the people being able to focus all their energies and all their talents in the area that they are a specialist in, and generally have the potential of doing a bang-up job, a real top-notch job in that. And so every area can be really good. There's benefits to that. Whereas one man, he can only spread himself so thin. And generally, he's not going to be an expert in every field. He's going to have a few areas that are his strong points. In the other areas, he's going to have to rely heavily on other previous works or other information, and he's just going to be able to just have to give that to you. So there's a strength in a committee work. There's a weakness because, like I say, it's only as strong as the weakest link, and so it's they're generally pretty up and down. But on the other hand, a one-man work, his viewpoint, he can make sure that his viewpoint comes out in every article in that work, whatever it is. Whereas a committee work, there's almost always some compromise involved because no two people on the face of the earth agree theologically in every little itsy-bitsy, teensy-weensy, tiny point of interpretation of every scripture of the thousands of the Bible. There's no two men that are mirror images of each other theologically. And usually some are, in some quiet areas, far apart. And so there's always compromise involved, even as there are in Bible translation work that's committee work, as proof of the King James Version, which had Anglicans and Puritans. And the Anglicans were non-Calvinists. They believed in man's free will. And the Puritans were staunch hyper-Calvinists who believed sovereign grace of God and were puppets, basically, and predestination. And so when they got over some of the sticky passages in the Pauline epistles where it talked about falling away from the faith and things that talk about our salvation and the conditional aspect of it, they would wrangle over that, and they'd have to make a decision. Well, how are we going to translate this word? If we translate it this way, it seems to bring this part out. If we translate it this way, it brings that one out. And they'd wrangle and debate and vote and check the Greek and check the Hebrew. And then finally, they would compromise. And so in some places, they came down on the predestination side. And I can show you scriptures that bring that out. For example, Acts 2. Getting kind of far afield here, but maybe you'll get something out of this anyway. For example, in the book of Acts, chapter 2, talking about the day of Pentecost and Peter's sermon and those that got saved, it says in Acts 2:47 that they were praising God, having favor with all the people, and the Lord added to the church daily such as should be saved. Now that sounds Calvinistic. You know, the ones that should be saved, the ones that God picks to be saved out of the world, see, arbitrarily, over and above their free will, that the church was being added daily, such as should be saved. Well, you'll be saved and you'll be saved, and those are the ones that are being added. But that's not what the Greek says. The Greek says there was the Lord added to the church daily those being saved. That's all the Greek says, those being saved. And so whoever wanted to, you know, would come in, and they were being saved and they were being added to the church, not those as such as should be saved. And so that would smack of Calvinism the way it's been translated. So most likely in that particular instance, the Calvinists won out over the Puritans won out over the Anglicans, and so they went that way. And then there were other cases where they went the other way. So committee work almost always is going to entail compromise, and that's a weakness for that side. By the way, if this story whetted your appetite for more information concerning the translation of our revered and beautiful King James Version, we've got a book in the Bible Translations and Manuscripts section called Translating for King James by Boyce or Ward or somebody, and it's notes from, because one of the people on the committee of the King James translation 1611 took notes of some of the debates and some of the scriptures they wrangled over and what it was like. The only one that took any notes, or at least the only one that took any notes that have survived, and this person went through and he's given commentary on the notes, and he's given the notes. Very interesting and intriguing book. We've got that if you want it. There's even a couple other books that talk about how we got our King James Bible and what some of the men were like, background, and their so forth. And it is worth knowing something about this because it's not going to pass away. You've got to, you can't throw it away even though it's only a mediocre translation. You throw your papers away that are in it, but because that's the Bible to the world. To the world, the Bible, or the English-speaking world, is the King James Bible, and most of them don't even know hardly anything about other translations. So we're always going to be using it as a basis to start from, even though we branch out into others and modify and get more accurate information. It's going to be our base, because all your reference works, concordances, commentaries, almost all of them are based on this translation. And if you're just going to be dogmatic on using an NASB and no King James, you're going to make a lot more work for yourself when you get into using the biblical reference works. But anyway, where was I? Oh, yes, committee work and then one-man work. So they have strengths and weaknesses. The one-man work, he's generally going to be skimming over some areas and not going to be as strong as committees. And so there's pros and cons. It's not necessarily one or the other. Well, you know, people are complex. And there's a tendency to, and we fall prey to this sometimes too, and to a certain extent it's necessary in order for a mind, for a human mind to make distinctions, see? Because basically thinking, the process of thinking, is making judgments. To think, you know, you see this, and that's two fingers, three fingers, four. You make a judgment. Your mind is distinguishing one thing from another. And so there's a certain amount of necessity in categorizing people as well as other things. But it's probably unfair to oversimplify motives, for example, of why people do what they do in the realm of biblical sciences and biblical scholarship. I could oversimplify and say, well, some, all they want to do is get a name and a degree and publish and make money and be famous, and it's all a pride thing. And then the others, they've got the heart for God, and they have a vision, and whatever light they had, they're using it, and God's using it. I could oversimplify it and say it's either one or the other, but it's not always that simple. There's a multitude of reasons, because each person who wrote one of these was a human being who had, you know, a whole life. He had an education, he had friends, he had a wife, he had children, he had a job, he had a goal, he had a purpose. And so who knows, just like in our own lives, the multitude of factors that come into play that cause us to make the decisions that we make in our lives, obviously we're operating in their lives as well. Maybe one man, because his father was a prestigious professor in the ivy-colored, you know, ivy walls of Yale or something, he felt the same, you know, goal. He felt the same, almost an obligation to follow his father's footsteps. So there was strong parental pressure there for him to get in and go to Yale and graduate from Yale, class of 32, you know, and go on and get his PhD and what doctorate or whatever. Maybe that was it. Maybe his wife. Maybe just he liked to learn. He liked facts. He liked to use his mind. Maybe there was monetary incentive. Maybe there was pride incentive. Maybe there was something for the Lord. And in a lot of cases, almost probably every case, it's never just one factor, but a combination of factors. But they vary as to how each factor, the degree of each factor in any one individual's life. But just to give you an example, I believe that in Miller's case, Andrew Miller, knowing the little I know about his life, and knowing what I do know about his church history, I would say that one of the strong motivating factors in his life was to glorify the Lord when he wrote that church history, and to give the Christians a spiritual insight into what otherwise would just be a series of events and popes and church denominations and movements, but to get them beneath the surface of who said what to who and why, when, where, and how, and to give them the spiritual undercurrents of how the enemy was moving, how the Lord was moving, and to give some spiritual depth to the church history. And I believe that he was a born-again Christian. Quite sure he was. Don't know if he was Spirit-filled or not. Probably not. Not too many were back then, the 1800s. But he was a member of the Brethren Church. And the Brethren Church was a very devout group. And they didn't want to call themselves, you know, a church. They were the Brethren. They were the ones started by John Nelson Darby, and B.W. Newton and Samuel Peter Dulles was in it. In fact, many of the reference works that we have, including Englishman's and Englishman's Greek Concordance, Englishman's Hebrew Concordance, and many of these other works, Analytical Greek and Analytical Hebrew, were done by George V. Wigram, who was a Brethren, and our translation of Gesenius's Hebrew Grammar was done by Samuel Preacher Jealous, who was a Brethren, and he worked in the manuscripts and produced the Greek text as well. And Darby was one of the most scholarly, and he's the one who, in a sense, rediscovered the rapture doctrine in the Bible in the 1800s. So the Brethren were really heavy into the Word. They were really keen on studying the Word of God and knowing the doctrines, and God was using this heart that they had to use them to rediscover truths, many of which had been lost for several centuries in the church. And Andrew Miller was one of the Brethren, and I believe that, you know, he really had a heart for the Lord in what he did. If I could fault him on anything in his church history, it would be lack of documentation. He doesn't document a vast amount of what he gives. By documentation, I mean sources. What is his source for that information? Where are his footnotes? Where is his bibliographies? He doesn't say a whole lot. He's a little bit lax and unscholarly in that area of documenting historically what he says. And therefore, with lack of documentation, how do we know where he got his information from, if he got it from a good source or a biased source, if he got it from a primary, secondary, or tertiary source, if he's got it from a source and he's giving it straight to us, or if he got it and he interpreted it and gave it to us, if he didn't tell us that, and how good it is and how good it isn't. And so sometimes you have to check up on him and use him with one of the more objective and yet sometimes liberal ones that document everything that a lot of what they say and kind of balance him out a little bit in that area. But for spirituality, he's probably second to none in the church history field. Probably second to none. I would say that some of the others that would be close would be Milner, M-I-L-N-E-R. Milner's church history. Isaac, I think is his name, Isaac Milner. That's that beautiful leather-bound, gilt-tooled, gilt-edged, tool, hand-tooled, a full-calf bound book on church history that we have in the church history section that many people confuse with Miller's, two different things. Because Milner wrote only up to the 1700s, I think, or early 1800s, his is completed. But he had a heart for God, too. Also, Laterette, I think, had a heart and a real vision for missions and evangelism. And you see a real emphasis on that in his church history. And he even wrote several volumes on missionary work and so forth as well. So different things, just a whole host, combination of factors were coming into play here. And in some cases, I think that it's possible that some of these men may not have even been born again, or maybe just barely so, nominally so, and really were ensconced in the world of liberalism and intellectualism and were, you know, maybe didn't even have all the best motives. But in a sense, God could even use them too, because I have found this to be a case sometimes in biblical works, and that is this. A lot of times the conservatives, the ones who believe the Word of God, they believe it's inspired, they believe in the supernatural element, the miraculous element of the Bible, they have a heart for God and they're trying to work for the Lord, but they also have theology. They also have their beliefs and their doctrines. And maybe 60 or 70% of what they believe, you know, fundamentalists and so forth, is good and true, but maybe a certain percentage of it isn't. But they still believe it and hold to it dogmatically, and sometimes so much so that they will tend to color some of the information that they give you, and you have to watch for that, even among conservatives. Not necessarily consciously so, maybe just subconsciously. They're looking through those glasses, and that's what they see. There are Calvinists. See, many Calvinists have been some of the most fantastic men of God. They've been predestination people. Jonathan Edwards, for example. John Wesley's close friend who preached, who had leather lungs, who could be heard a country mile and preached to one time 40,000 people outdoors with no amplification in England, and who came across and he was used of God in mighty revivals in church history. He was a Calvinist, and he had some bitter controversies and arguments with his brother in the Lord, John Wesley, over this, because Wesley was, of course, an Arminian. He believed in free will of man and so forth. But Calvinist, and yet look how God used him, and look at the heart that he had for God. But theologically, I wouldn't follow Jonathan Edwards, George Whitfield, I meant to say. Did I say Jonathan Edwards the first time? George Whitfield is what I meant to say. Jonathan Edwards was a Calvinist too, but he was over in America, and he's the one who preached Sinner in the Hands of an Angry God, and he started a revival in Yale, which is, I believe, his father founded as well. Yale, incidentally, many of these universities started out to be religious colleges, religious schools, and it was only later that they turned into the liberal, you know, bunkhouses they are now. But, almost lost my train of thought again. Oh, yes. So sometimes the fundamentalists and the conservatives, if you don't watch it, they can slant some of the information that are given. Whereas, on the other hand, the liberals, who, of course, you don't go to for theology and doctrine in many of these areas, because they don't, well, Jesus couldn't have done that. I mean, we know they couldn't have crossed the Red Sea. We know that's impossible. That's an underlying assumption in everything they do, so they try to explain it away. Yet, on the other hand, many of them are so, in a sense, carefree, they don't even care about what it is they're going to find or what it is they come up with, that sometimes they can be the more objective. Because they don't care what they find. They don't care what the outcome of it is, how it affects their theology. They have no theology. Theirs is the theology of chance or fate or evolution or whatever. And so whatever is, and sometimes they can be more objective in their handling of the facts and the data than some of the others. And so sometimes I'll go to them. For example, Walker, Williston Walker, Walker's church history. I have a feeling that he may have had some liberal positions in some of his theology, but he's got it. It's a good church history. It's one of the best, and it's pretty objective in a lot of what it presents. And even Lauderette, Kenneth S. Lauderette, who I said had a heart for missions, I think he had some liberal theology as well, but he's got a very good church history. And Schaff, an older one, late 1800s, but very, very thorough, as you've seen if you've used it. He was liberal in some of his theological positions, and yet he can be objective at times as well. So it's just some little things you'll learn as you go through these books about man and the nature of man and what, you know, what he does with what he presents us and how to use them, in a sense. Okay, any other questions on church history section before we move on? All right, let's look at the Old Testament history section. OT history. Again, the category name is self-explanatory. You know what you're going to find in there. You're not going to find homiletics. You're not going to find commentaries. You're going to find history of the Old Testament. So this section recounts and develops the life and existence of basically the Hebrew people. Now, the reason I say that is because when you read the Old Testament, it's not a full-blown history of Assyria, Babylonia, Egypt, Syria, the Sumerians, the Armenians, and so forth. It doesn't even bother to tell you about a lot of those nations. Only when they come in connection with God's chosen people. It's basically a history of God's plan of salvation with man. But since that plan involves men and nations, particularly Israel, that's what the Bible in the Old Testament focuses on. So it's basically a history of Israel and Assyria and these other nations when they come into contact with Israel. And that's basically what it is. And these books recount that history. Now you say, well, what can they say if we've already got it in the Old Testament? Are they just putting it in their own words? Well, they do some of that. They'll paraphrase what you see in the Old Testament. They'll condense it so that where you'll read 25 chapters in Genesis about Abraham's life, maybe they'll summarize it in 3 pages, just succinct paragraphs, which can be of fantastic value. If you don't have time to read through a whole long section of history in the Bible and you want them to condense it and distill it into one, you know, weighty paragraph, they do that type of thing for you. And then they'll give you the scripture references if you want. But they do more than just that, too. They do more than just condense the history and spit it back out to you. They tie in outside information, what we know from the monuments, from archaeology, from the findings about these Hebrews and various nations, and how that sheds light upon the Bible history, and how geography sheds light on it. So they do bring other things into play, and they try to write it in an interesting and informative manner, and document it, and so forth. Some of the more commonly used references in this area are on my next page. One is called the Survey of Israel's History. I believe that's the title. By Wood. I think his first name is Leon. Another one is called Israel and the Nation. And that's by F.F. Bruce. Another is called An Historical Survey of the Old Testament by Merrill. I believe his name is Eugene. First name. Now, all three of these books are recently done. These men are all contemporaries of us. They're still alive. They've been done, in the 1960s or 50s. And F.F. Bruce's book, Israel and the Nations, as you'll notice by the title, he brings in quite a bit of information about what were the other nations doing at, when David reigned, what were the Syrians doing, what were the Assyrians doing, what was going on in their national life, how were they developing as nations right alongside of Israel throughout history. And so he brings in a lot of that. By the way, he's a brethren too, F.F. Bruce is. He's written a whole host of books, most of which are pretty excellent. Well done. He's written commentaries on Acts and Hebrews, and I don't know about Hebrews, but Acts and some other things. Epistles of John. Then this other one, Historical Survey of the Old Testament by Merrill. It's a pretty much chronological presentation from, you know, the creation all the way through the, I think, the dispersion, the captivity of Israel and Judah. And then he kind of ties in the Old Testament books with them. So when you're in the period of the conquest of Canaan's land, he'll give you a brief little sketch of the book of Joshua, because that's what that book covers. And he'll give you maybe title, author, date, purpose, and a brief outline and show you how it fits in this period of history, and then he'll go on with his running account of the history of the Old Testament. There are some others here. Well, one other. There's one that's called Bible History. The Old Testament by Edersheim. Alfred, I think his name is Edersheim, and he wrote around the turn of the century, I believe, early part of this century. He was a converted Jew, by the way, and he was a interesting scholar in that he was. He knew Hebrew, of course, being a converted Jew, and he was very, very widely read in all of the rabbinical literature, all of the Torah, the Talmud, the Mishnah, all the commentaries and all the writings of the Hebrews and rabbis throughout the ages and on what their interpretations of the Bible was and what their view of history and everything else. And he brings all of this fantastic information about the history of Israel and what their life and customs and background and philosophy was. He brings all this to bear upon the history of the Old Testament, and he's able to shed a lot of a really interesting and significant light on it. He's written several other books. He wrote Jesus the Messiah, a book about New Testament history and Jesus, and oh no, it's called The Life and Times of Jesus the Messiah. I think that's what it's called. It's probably the standard work. It's probably the standard Life of Christ work. And by the way, that's where we have our Life of Christ books as well, I think. No, not in Old Testament history. It would be in the New Testament section, I think, New Testament history. But he wrote that. That's a standard work on the Life of Christ. And it's probably never been surpassed in this area of bringing to bear all the customs and meanings of these things that they did and all his Hebrew background on that, although it's been outdated in some areas by some of the more recent books that can bring more archaeological things to bear upon it. But it's still a standard work. And he's written other books. He's written books on Bible customs. I think there's one called Life, Social Life in Jewish Times or something like that, Jewish Social Life. Several books, but he's got this book on Old Testament. We've got several different copies and editions of it, Old Testament history, in the library. Yes? I think he became Trinitarian, but I'm not sure on that. And for a Jew, that's practically like throwing away, you know, everything that he knows. It's just like intellectual suicide for them to do that. And I think it's going to be interesting to note how the coming back to the belief, the biblical belief of the nature of God, is a much better way to bring the Jews to the Lord, so that they don't have to throw away, you know, the first and greatest commandment, you know, when they come to the Messiah. And I believe the Lord's going to use that to bring most assuredly many of them in before the rapture. But I'm not sure. I'm not sure in this case, because I can't remember any particular comment now of his where he said that he was or not. You'd have to read through it and check. But as a denomination, no. As a denominational stand and position, they're somewhat akin to the Baptists in many of their beliefs and stands concerning the gifts passing away in the apostolic age and different things like that. But there are some exceptions, just like in all the denominations now. You see some whole churches that have become spirit-filled, even though the majority of their denomination isn't. And the brethren give much liberty to each individual brethren congregation to move and to teach as they believe. And so you've got some whole congregations of the brethren that are spirit-filled and some individuals among the brethren, a movement that are spirit-filled. But as a church and as a denomination, no, that is not their position. Okay, any questions on the Old Testament history section of the library? All right, let's look at, let me say this about it before I move on. It's also got some specialized work in it as well. Just narrow areas about one nation or one group of nations or one period. Maybe the period of the judges is focused in on. In fact, I think we've got one in there by Wood, I think, about the desperate days of dark days of the judges or something like that. I don't think it's a commentary in the commentary section. I think it's in the Old Testament section, and it's on just one narrow aspect, one part of Old Testament history. So again, as in the other cases, you've got more specialized works that you should look for if you're looking for one subject as well. All right? Evangelism is the next section I'm going to mention. Of course, evangelism, any book on this you're going to have dealing with the subject of witnessing, evangelizing the world, and methods to use in evangelizing, and goals, and so forth.
Everybody's probably got this by now. I'm going to erase this and write something on the board here. Just a couple examples of books in this section. There's one called How to Work for Christ. Abbreviate Christ by R.A. Torrey. That name may ring a bell. He was the successor to Dwight L. Moody in Moody's ministry. He started the Moody Bible College there and was the president of it for many years. He was used to the Lord to carry on the work of Moody. How to Work for Christ. So he was in a good position to be able to, over his years and years and years of experience, talking to people one-on-one and dealing with them and preaching and teaching and so forth, to come up with a lot of good principles concerning evangelism. Another one's called The Soul Winner by Spurgeon, found in that section. Spurgeon was the famous golden-tongued orator, the preacher, and Spurgeon's Tabernacle there in London in the 1800s. One who had a church that held about 5,000 or 6,000, which he packed out with some of the cream of London, including politicians and prime ministers and leaders from all over who would come to hear him and his beautiful sermons that he would preach. Another one called Revival Lecture by Charles G. Finney. Again, we're talking about another man of God who was used in a mighty way in the last century, middle part of the 1800s, great move of God, and he would give you some principles concerning evangelism. Now, there's mass evangelism, and there's one-on-one, and some of these cover different aspects of it. Another one's called The Divine Art of Soul Winning. Divine Art of Soul Winning by Sanders. Obviously, the class that is going to be most benefited by this section is the personal evangelism. We have a class called Personal Evangelism where they deal with this whole area and give you principles on how to witness and
certain types of people that you're going to meet and the types of things that they're going to say and how you can deal with certain types of individuals and how to minister for the Lord in this area. And these are some of the books that deal with that. All right, the next section is English, unless there's any questions on the evangelism section. English is basically just a very, very small section, just a few books in it, that will help those that are taking writing lab and what's the other one that we have? Refining English skills or something like that. The two classes that we have to help those that come in to get on board and be able to express themselves in print, to write things and speak and put our language together, use it, and that's what these books are basically for, to supplement that area, that class. Christian education is another rather specialized category in the library, and here you find the books that give you the perspectives and principles and methods of how to present the gospel and teach up and train children. Christian education, so it's all about that, and we've got courses in Christian ed in the Bible College, and these are basically background books for that course. For example, just one book called Principles of Teaching for Christian Teachers by Eavey. Principles of Teaching for Christian Teachers. Then there's the New Testament history section. And this, of course, deals with the history that starts with Christ himself, gospel history, John the Baptist, Jesus Christ, his life, his birth, life, ministry, death, resurrection, ascension. That's New Testament history. But also, following on into the book of Acts, where the church is started, Jesus ascends, pours out the Holy Spirit on the 120 at Pentecost, 3,000 get saved, later 5,000 get saved, the 12 apostles go throughout the land preaching the gospel. Saul gets saved, his name gets changed to Paul, he becomes the apostle to the Gentiles. The gospel begins to be spread into Asia Minor, Greece, Italy, all around the world, and continuing right on through the book of Acts. That's all what we call New Testament history. And this is all related from a historical point of view in these books. And this is where you find also the books on the life of Christ, the life of Paul, and just specialized works on certain men in the New Testament history section. By the way, going back to Old Testament history for a second, the Old Testament history is going to help you in, and this is pretty obvious, survey of Old Testament history, which I'm going to be teaching next semester. Anybody in here that signed up for that? Nobody in this class. Survey of Old Testament history. That only gets taught spring semester. And that's only on odd-numbered years, I think. Maybe it's every spring. I think it's every spring semester it's slated to go. So it'll be taught again spring after. But Survey of Old Testament History, Survey of Old Testament Books, and, of course, any other class that deals with the Old Testament, from Genesis to Isaiah to Psalms to historical books, this is going to help them in that section there. Now, back to New Testament history. Perspectives of the Gospels is going to profit from looking in this section. The book of Acts, Pauline epistles, Apocalypse, Daniel, all of these general epistles, they're all dealing with, you know, New Testament history, and this section will help to supplement the information there. Just to give you a couple titles. I'll probably get caught by the bell here. Let's put them real quick. There's one called A Class Book of New Testament History by McClear, which is pretty good. Another one is the one I mentioned by Edersheim, The Life and Times of Jesus, the Messiah. Let me give you just one more here. The Life, and this is a real standard word here too, The Life and Epistles of
St. Paul or Paul by Coney Bear and Howson. It's somewhat older work, I think done around the turn of the century, but it's still very excellent in much of its description of the life of Paul and his epistles and the chronology involved.
Paul by Coney Bear and Howson, Life and Epistles of St. Paul. Okay, that was our last bell, so that's it for this semester. We'll be coming back in January and picking up on this information. Jamie. Jamie, favor? Yes, and then you can just put it in the water.
I turned in sign with him to do last Thursday. I didn't box him Sunday or Monday. Not done with that yet.
No, so you'll want to pick it up in the library. Hi, Tony.
Hi. My take notes are done.
For Holy Spirit?
Yeah. I copied them from Tony May.
Well, that's okay. Next year's another year, another semester.
Sure, we're going to try better.
Okay, great. Yes. What are we supposed to do? Fill this out with all the books in there?
In that section, right.
Okay.
You might, if you need another piece of paper, you could maybe just line one out yourself, like on that. Okay, we've got the 12th of December.
Well, and you should have the 9th of October.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And the 1st of November.
Got them all.
Okay.
Great. Good, Tony. Good work.